morning. Mayfield will be represented by Mr. Thomas Leatherberry. Leatherberry is the reserve project to the vote.
May it please the court. Three primary factors support the nuisance request for mandamus relief in this case. First, the plain language of Rule 7687. Second, the public policies behind the rule. And third, the history leading up to the passage of the rule by this court in 1990. I want to talk about each of those three factors in turn. But first, by way of introduction, I'd like to discuss the facts just very briefly to frame the issue as we see it. It's not a petition for writ of mandamus with a lot of lurking fact questions. It doesn't have a voluminous record, and it doesn't lend itself to multicolored visual aids during oral argument. Ms. Hall and I struggled mightily to think of a way to recycle the chart with the red team and the blue team from the Epic case, but we could not as much as we racked our brains. There really only are four undisputed facts. First, in this medical negligence case, the parties signed a Rule 11 agreement about discovery and exchange documents. Two,
was the agreement in any way in compliance with the requirements under 76A with respect to sealing?
No, Your Honor. Second fact, the trial court was never asked to sign and never signed a protective order or a sealing order. And I think that also goes to your question, Justice Gonzalez. Three, the case settled and judgment was entered. Four, 112 days later, the morning news intervened, seeking access to the discovery documents exchanged between the parties.
Were any of these documents that were under the Rule 11 agreement ever a part of the public record?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. But that's...
Your argument is that where you're going is the full breadth of 76A, which, if you read it, it appears to say that people's private documents become a matter of public record merely by the request for the documents.
Yes, Your Honor. We want the opportunity to go back to the trial court and have the trial court conduct an in-camera inspection of the documents and introduce any other evidence we can so that we can try and meet our burden under Keppel and the other cases to show that these discovery documents are court records, even though they were unfiled under the definition of the rule.
So your position is, irrespective of a Rule 11 agreement, let's just say there was a normal exchange of documents, the case settled, 2 years later, you want all the unfiled discovery, and you say that 76A applies to all unfiled discovery.
Yes, Your Honor. I think we should have the opportunity to intervene and try to establish that that unfiled discovery is court records as defined under the rule.
But now, as a subsection 7 says, any person may intervene to seal or unseal.
Yes, sir.
You're not trying to seal.
No, sir.
So you're trying to unseal.
Yes, sir.
But how can a Rule 11 agreement seal, or in Judge Owen's question, how could just not doing anything have the effect of sealing?
Let me answer that question directly, Your Honor. It's our position that the plain language of Rule 76A7, of the first sentence particularly, addresses a situation where the court hasn't acted, hasn't entered a sealing order, hasn't entered an unsealing order, and it allows intervention as a matter of right at any time before or after judgment by any person. And under that language of the first sentence of Rule 76A7, we think the morning news intervention was proper, and the trial court had continuing jurisdiction, even though the traditional plenary power period had expired.
But you don't ordinarily think of records being sealed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because nobody has given them to the press.
Well, Your Honor,
Go ahead.
I think it's a distinction without a difference. The Kaiser's argument is that two arguments. First, they say you ignore the first sentence of the rule, 76A7, and just focus on the second one that talks about when the trial court has entered a sealing order and has continuing jurisdiction to modify, alter, or vacate that sealing order. Two, they say, gotcha. Nobody asked the court to seal the records, the court didn't enter a sealing order. We simply did it by way of a Rule 11 agreement. And it's our position, Your Honor, that that's sophistry. It's a distinction without a difference. It elevates form over substance. The records are sealed because access to them is limited, no matter whether it's through a sealing order or through a Rule 11 agreement. And I think, Judge, that too, we talked a little bit already about the plain language of Rule 76A7. Justice Abbott, you had a question.
I do on the language. If the rule were the way you wanted it to be, mm-hmm. why would it not have been written? Say any person may intervene as a matter of right at any time before or after judgment to seek or obtain records, as opposed to seal or unseal records. Why doesn't the exact, precise language of the rule contradict what you're urging?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because I think it really and truly is a distinction without a difference. I think that under the plain language of the rule, I think the records are sealed because the news hasn't been able to have access to them. The news has requested access to them. And now, under the guise of this Rule 11 agreement, they say it's just too late. And I think...
Wouldn't it be different, and doesn't the issue change if this litigation were still pending? And the morning news came forward, the parties are litigating, discovery is being undertaken, documents have not been filed with the court, no one's gone to the court one way or another, and the morning news goes to the courthouse to try to gain access to this. Doesn't that then create a different circumstance because we do not have an issue about the court's jurisdiction?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the heart of the issue in this case is whether or not at this point in time, 112 days after judgment, after the trial court's plenary power has expired, whether or not the trial court has jurisdiction to do anything with respect to these documents.
We totally agree, Your Honor.
And that's why the specific language of Section 7 of Rule 76A becomes important, because we are asked to determine in this case whether or not under 76A7 the trial court in fact has jurisdiction to undertake Rule 76A proceedings.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why doesn't the specific language, as Judge Abbott said, in 76A7 become very important?
Oh, I think it is very important, Your Honor, but I think under our urging or our construction of the first sentence of Rule 76A7, these records are sealed. I'm not sure I can...
Are they sealed because of the Rule 11 agreement?
Yes,
or are
Your Honor.
They sealed just because they're discovery?
They're sealed by way of the Rule 11 agreement.
So if you didn't have the Rule 11 agreement, you wouldn't be here today?
No, I think, Your Honor, if there was an unfiled Rule 11 agreement, if there was no agreement at all, we might be here. I can't say as a matter of certainty that we wouldn't be here. But I do want to talk...
How would you, given the specific language of 76A7, argue that in fact the trial court has jurisdiction? When we have nothing, we don't have a protective order, we don't have a sealing order, we don't have a Rule 11 agreement even between the parties, where the parties attempted to make the documents confidential.
If access to the documents is restricted by informal agreement with parties, by Rule 11 agreement, certainly by sealing order under Keppel, our argument is the same.
Parties haven't even by informal agreement restricted them. They've just said the lawsuit's over. I don't have to just because you show up at my door and say I'd like to have your business records, give them to me.
Your Honor, obviously that's not the situation presented in this case, but I think our argument would be right. Well, I think our argument would be the same, is my answer to you. And let me flip it around a little bit, because I think the error of the Court of Appeals opinion becomes even more apparent when you recognize, as Justice Heck pointed out, that the rule provides even-handedly for sealing or unsealing, for intervention to seal or unseal records after judgment, at any time after judgment, intervention is a matter of right. If you take the hypothetical where the parties enter into an agreement that places no restrictions on discovery, they enter into a Rule 11 agreement and they say, there are no limits on this discovery. They go file that agreement, they get documents, judgment's entered, the case settles, plenary power expires, and then a non-party finds out that its sensitive, it's private information, it's business information, has been filed or exchanged as part of that lawsuit. It just finds it out. In order to be consistent with its interpretation of the rule that you need a sealing order, and you know, we're flat out of luck because we're 112 days after judgment, you would have to, Kaiser would have to say that the trial court has no jurisdiction to seal in that case. I think that exemplifies the fallacy in the Dallas Court of Appeals.
But how do we...
Elevation...
In that situation,
yes.
in the situation where there is no agreement and the lawsuit's over, we are looking at continuing jurisdiction.
Yes.
And that for this rule, I think everyone agrees the trial court's plenary jurisdiction is gone. This is the only thing that gives the trial court plenary jurisdiction. And the second sentence says, a court that issues a sealing order retains continuing jurisdiction.
Yes, sir.
So unless there's a sealing order or something, you argue Rule 11 agreement, assuming there's nothing, no agreement at all, how do we get around the words issues a sealing order, retains jurisdiction?
You get them from the first sentence of Rule 76A7. The language that you just read, Justice Owen, is the second sentence of Rule 76A7. And we submit to the court that our construction of the first two sentences of Rule 76A7 gives effect to both sentences, whereas Kaiser's interpretation and the interpretation accepted by the Dallas Court of Appeals leaves the first sentence out of the rule, and you're only left with the second sentence.
In your view, how long might parties who have voluntarily exchanged documents and made up a Rule 11 agreement and nobody's mentioned sealing or protection or anything else, how long might they be liable to the possibility of a third party coming in and in essence reopening a review of the dispute?
Well, I understand from being involved in the discussions about Rule 76A that obviously was a key concern of the courts. And I think the court has acted through the rulemaking process to place potentially some practical limits on that through New Rule 191.4D, which establishes a retention period for unfiled discovery. As I say, that's a practical limitation that the lawyers are bound to retain for that period. I do want to talk a little bit about the plain language of Rule 11, too, because I think that what you see in the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion is an elevation of Rule 11 to some sacrosanct status above Rule 76A. And I think it's important to note...
Why isn't this just a question of whether or not the morning news waited too long?
Well, I think that's...
If the position is that, and apparently there was some publicity over this case, and when the summary jury trial was held and so on, there was a lot of activity associated with that, and if in fact at that point in time, under the paragraph, we didn't have a jurisdictional question, and paragraph one of the rule would have allowed the morning news to go in and have a 76A proceeding to access the discovery in this case, why is it this just a question of the morning news having rested on its rights and waited too long beyond the time that the court's jurisdiction expired, as happens all the time in connection with litigation when parties wait too long?
I understand your question.
We're not depriving the morning news of a right. We're just saying morning news be on top of things and go get the documents while the trial court still has jurisdiction.
I understand that question. In fact, Kaiser has raised waiver in their motion to strike. In this case, Your Honor, because we're dealing with the continuing jurisdiction language of 76A7, it's not a question of waiver. I think waiver in this case is a fact issue really in search of a record, because Kaiser certainly had the opportunity to press its waiver argument and introduce testimony of that in the trial court. They chose not to. It was not found by the trial court. It was not found by the Court of Appeals. And there's no basis for this court to find these facts.
Under your interpretation in 76A7, there are no limits to the trial court's continuing jurisdiction.
Correct.
Well, let me ask you, without getting into the term waiver, I don't think we need to do that. If you look at the third sentence of 76A7, and my understanding is you are equating the Rule 11 agreement to a sealing order. You're saying it's the same thing.
Same exact.
So if you read that third sentence and say an order sealing or unsealing court records, so let's just say the Rule 11 agreement, shall not be reconsidered on motion of any party or intervener who had actual notice of the hearing preceding issuance of the order. And if we're going to substitute Rule 11 for Rule 11 agreement for the order sealing, then why can't we say actual notice was given by the filing of the Rule 11 agreement? Why can't, we don't need to get into a waiver argument. Doesn't the third sentence of that rule show that exactly what Justice Hankinson has said, that the Dallas Morning News sat on its rights and can't now come in?
I think Kaiser can't have it both ways. I think that there was no, if you look at the proceedings, there was no sealing here. There was no hearing at all before the court.
Yeah.
Certainly the rule out of the agreement was filed in the public record, and that is not in dispute, but there was no hearing.
Well, but again, my question is, if we're going to bend this language a little bit, this says order sealing or unsealing, and you're trying to equate that with Rule 11. I mean, isn't the filing of the Rule 11 agreement the same as a hearing if we're going to equate them in that way?
No, Your Honor, because the other procedures under 76A would have to be followed. The notice, the posting of notice, the opportunity to be heard, the hearing.
We've held otherwise in Keppel. We held in Keppel that you can have a 166B order entered, presumably by agreement of the parties without hearing. And if the court, and no one says 76A, the court doesn't have to do a 76A proceeding.
But in Keppel, you didn't foreclose the possibility that somebody, even somebody who was a party to that protective order, could come back and say 76A and then have the court record determination.
But if you had notice
and
of
the
all
posting.
If you had notice of all that, that there was a 166B order entered by the court, why would you be foreclosed, as Justice O'Neill was asking, under the third sentence of Section 7?
Well, first of all, I don't think there's a record of any of that because nobody introduced any testimony in the trial court in Judge Marshall's court at the hearing in June of last year. So that is not in the record in this case.
Well, what's not in the record?
There's no evidence in the record, Your Honor, about the actual, testimony about, I knew about the order and so forth.
The Rule 11 agreement is on file, and it says what the agreement is, that these documents will be confidential. So, I mean, surely you know this.
There's no evidence in the record of actual notice of the filing of that agreement.
But is the filing itself actual
notice?
No, no.
First of all, there was a huge debate when Rule 76A was passed about constructive notice and actual notice. And I would think that the filing is at best constructive notice and not the actual notice required by the third sentence of the rule.
Mr. Lesbury, your viewpoint was that the continuing jurisdiction is ad infinitum under the rule. Doesn't that create the tension with just a matter of course destruction of records like that by either or both sides? And if you choose to come in 2 years later and ask for a 76A hearing on those records, where does the court find itself under those kind of circumstances?
I think you're absolutely right, Justice Baker, and I think that that's one of the problems that the court acted to address in setting that retention period under Rule 191 for the in the rules that went into effect on January 1 by specifying the time period for which the attorneys had to hold on to unfiled discovery so there wouldn't be later accusations of spoliation of court records that
They hold them that long and they give them back to the parties. And then here you come. Later on, you say, well, but you should have kept them, Mr. Client. And so we're asking for them now because we can still have this hearing because there's a court with continuing jurisdiction.
Obviously, those aren't the facts of this case. But I would think that as a practical limitation, the retention period in 191.4D sets some limits. Well, I think it does set some limits because I don't see if the attorneys have complied with the rule of retention that I can, maybe go elsewhere and get the documents or what have you. But I think that does set some limits on the attorney's responsibility to hold on to the documents.
Any other questions? Thank you, Bill. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I tell you the court, respondents to real parties in interest will be represented by Mr. R. Brent Cooper.
May I please the court,
really the only issue in this case is whether or not this Rule 11 agreement extended the plenary power of the trial court in this case.
Let's assume it did. Let's assume we affirm the court of appeals.
Okay.
Why would Rule 11 not create a hole in Rule 76A such that it would fairly obliterate it?
Two reasons. First off, this court, through the new rules that were just passed, encourages the parties to resolve as many of the discovery disputes as possible through agreements.
Well, that doesn't help me if I'm an intervener.
Okay, that's
part of the argument. I don't have an argument at all if I'm an intervener.
Okay, I understand it, but they're saying you got to go through the whole, the 76A process all the time. That can't be the case, because this court in Keppel recognized that it is an onerous process to go through the hearing, the notice. It's expensive, consumes time for the court, it consumes time for the litigants. They are not going to want the parties to do that every time.
So let me be clear on my question, because first answer hurts yourself, doesn't help you.
How is the public protected? Is what your question is.
Right.
The public is protected because, first off, there is notice to the public that there is a Rule 11 agreement. It is filed of record. The only difference between
that rule... Actual notice. That's not actual.
Well, it's as much actual notice as, for example, posting it downstairs at the courthouse, like it's required in Rule 76A with all the other notices from the courthouse. Unless you go out there and happen to read them, you're not going to know that there is indeed a Rule 76A motion that's pending before the 14th District Court up on the second floor. And so...
Okay, let me try to go through this factual scenario then.
Okay.
If we affirm the Court of Appeals, here's what is going to happen in cases around the state of Texas, and that is that in any meaningful case where there are documents that one party does not want the public to know about, when the other side is not strongly averse to not disclosing those documents, you're going to have a Rule 11 agreement entered into that will forever shield those documents, and no one will ever be able to gain access to them.
I respectfully disagree with you, Justice Abbott, for this reason. Again, there is going to be notice to the public by the filing of the Rule 11 agreement in the records. Under the Dallas Time Settle case versus Jones, there were three important, and this was before Rule 76, it involved a Rule 11 agreement. And it said three things. One is, there is a public right of access to documents. And it also said that the agreement of the parties to... under Rule 11 to keep these documents secret is not binding on the trial judge. Rule 11 by its own terms says it's going to be binding between the parties, but the trial judge is not bound by the Rule 11 agreement. Third thing it said is the parties, in this case the Dallas Times Herald, has a right to come into the court. In that case it was the 95th, the Justice Head, and seek an order requiring those documents to be turned over.
And when this Rule 11 agreement is filed and the Dallas Morning News goes down there and happens to learn about it and reads the Rule 11 agreement, how are they to know that it involves the sealing of documents? Your answer, of course, would be, well, it's going to stay on its face. But any attorney worth his salt is going to be able to figure out a way to word the Rule 11 agreement such that it doesn't disclose to the world what it concerns. As an example, you can have a Rule 11 agreement that attorneys on both sides and parties on both sides agree to be bound by Document A. And Document A, of course, will be identified elsewhere, and no one in the world will know what Document A refers to except for the lawyers and parties.
I think pursuant to the common law that existed before Rule 76A and the common law that exists after Rule 76A, a private party such as the Morning News or such as the Dallas Times Herald when they were in business has a right to come into the court and say, Judge, here's a Rule 11 agreement. We think there may be some very sensitive documents that are important to public policy, important to public health, and we want access to those documents. The court at that point in time would hold a hearing to determine whether or not indeed, in this case, they fall within the criteria set forth in Rule 76A. If they do, the court would order them to be produced. If not, the court would say, I'm sorry,
They're not a public employee as far as the health and safety, administration of justice, or a business, or whatever, and we're not allowed to meet the difference.
We've held a Rule 11 agreement, need not be filed, be enforced. It can be filed later, and that protects the mediation process. What's to keep a party from coming in shortly before the expiration of the trial court's plenary jurisdiction and filing a Rule 11 agreement, knowing that as a practical matter, nobody's going to find out about it in 2 days?
Well, and I think this, Justice Sec, I think this goes back to one of the earlier questions, and that is, assuming there is no Rule 11 agreement, if there is a case of public importance, as the Dallas Morning News contends this case was, and we know that the Dallas Morning News is on notice that, you know, most of the discovery documents now aren't filed of record. And so they don't know, either with or without the Rule 11 agreement, there's going to be a lot of documents that aren't filed with the trial court, and if they think that they're of public importance, they can go into the court and say, we want to see the documents which have been produced in discovery in this case. And so I don't think the filing of the Rule 11 agreement necessarily would limit or enlarge their right to come into the court and seek the turnover of those documents.
Isn't it possible for a Rule 11 agreement to be made, not in writing, but you go down to open court, let me read it to you. Says that a Rule 11 agreement can be made in open court and entered of record. Why couldn't the parties, it's the last line in Rule 11, why couldn't the parties go down and dictate it into the record, into court reporter transcript, and each initial it and flip it to the record? No one will have a clue what it is. Unless someone goes down there and says, ah, please transcribe this.
Sure. And again, I think that is necessarily a distinction without a meaning, because the Dallas Morning News and the Times Herald is going to know that all the discovery documents are going to be unfiled now under the current rules. If they have access to them to look at them, they're going to know they're not going to be filed of record. And can request, can go in, whether or not there's a Rule 11 agreement to file, there's not a Rule 11 agreement to file, regardless of what the circumstances are, if they think the case is of importance, if we want to see the discovery in the case, they can go in, as the Times Herald did in the Jones case, and request access to those documents. That is a right they have. It's been recognized as a fundamental right that non-parties have, is to see the court records.
Switching gears over here slightly. Do you agree under subsection 7 that if there were a sealing order in the case, if the parties had gone in before the judgment and had a 76A hearing and gotten a sealing order, that an intervener could come in after the expiration of the court's plenary jurisdiction and challenge that order?
I'll say this. In all honesty, there is confusion for this reason. The sealing order is the document that confers continuing jurisdiction to the trial court. Clearly, in order for plenary power to be conferred to the trial court, there must be a sealing order within the trial court's plenary power.
Not necessarily. Couldn't you not have a sealing order, and doesn't the provision allow someone to come in to seal records as well? Jurisdiction to seal or unseal records. By the fact that you could come in, the rule reads in terms of sealing.
Okay, but the second line in paragraph 7 says, a court that issues a sealing order. And again, go up to paragraph 6, they talk about sealing or unsealing records, and similarly they talk about sealing or unsealing orders. The way I interpret the rule is only an order sealing records that confers continuing jurisdiction to the trial court.
I urge you to reread the first sentence. It says at any time a person has a right to seek an order after judgment to seal court records.
To seal or unseal court records. Okay. In fact, I think you've got to read all the rule together.
That means the language to seal court records is meaningless in the first sentence.
No. I think you can move to seal or unseal court records while there is plenary power. However, the only way the plenary power under the second sentence is extended is through a sealing order. Now, the other part you've got to read...
It says at any time before or after judgment.
Right, and I think one of the things they're talking about is under Rule 60, the intervention statute. under the Red Letter Richard statute, there is no right to intervene after judgment. In fact, it specifically says the right to intervene can only be done before there is a judgment, and there is no right to intervene after judgment.
Let me put it this way. Why would you seek an order to seal if there's already a sealing order?
I don't think you would.
Okay.
I mean, I think if there's already a sealing order, unless you're wanting to seal further documents or somehow expand the scope or the breadth of the sealing order, perhaps, maybe limited to more people than perhaps it was as far as the publication of the documents that it was originally, you want to do that. But the other part that you've got to read, I believe, is paragraph 4, which talks about intervention. And again, I'm not so sure how you, it's the second sentence, non-parties may intervene as a matter of right for the limited purpose of participating in the proceedings upon payment of a fee required for the filing of a plea intervention. And again, we're talking about proceedings to seal the records, which I believe...
And that's the purpose of the notice, to give anybody that wants to come in the opportunity to intervene, even though they don't have an interest in the litigation per se.
Correct. And that's correct. And once there's been a determination that they are court records, then the notice goes out and you start the procedure under Rule 76A.
Let me go back to my question just a minute. Make sure I understand that if there were a sealing order during the court's jurisdiction, is it your position that an intervener could then come in at any time after the plenary jurisdiction expired and modify that order?
My original statement, Justice Hatcher, was I think there is some confusion in the statute. I don't think that's been interpreted. I think you can certainly read the first sentence of paragraph 7 is holding that you can intervene during the continuing jurisdiction time period of the case. However, if you go to 4, it talks about intervening for the purpose of participating in the sealing hearing, which we know the sealing hearing, I believe, has to occur during the plenary time. We have to look at otherwise.
If it were true that you could do that, wouldn't it be wiser not to ever get a sealing order and hope that a Rule 11 agreement or maybe just silence would work out for the best?
Well, two things. One is, of course, when you have a sealing order, you have the imprimatur and you have the protection from the court. And it cuts both ways. For example, if there was a sealing order, if Mr. Scully and I are on opposite sides and we have a sealing order and he violates that, the court's continuing jurisdiction, I believe, would allow him to, again, perhaps take efforts or take sanctions against Mr. Scully. On the other hand, if we just have a Rule 11 agreement and the plenary jurisdiction of the court expires and there is a violation, for example, of a confidentiality agreement, the trial judge has no jurisdiction at all. It cuts both ways.
Well, but if you have a Rule 11 agreement, we know you can enforce it in other ways.
Pursuant to a new lawsuit, injunction, or something like that. Right. But you have to create and establish new jurisdiction with a new court in order to give effect to it. And I think that's the big distinction here between a Rule 11 agreement and a sealing order or a protective order.
In what respect is there a distinction?
The big distinction is when we're talking about jurisdiction, it's got to be from statute, rules, or the Constitution.
But this is the rule.
This is the rule, right. And when we're talking about continuing jurisdiction of the trial court, in those limited situations where statutes or rules do give continuing jurisdiction, is to enforce an order of the trial court.
Is it a fair statement to say, under your theory, you could, as Judge Abbott asked at the very outset of your argument, that by using a Rule 11 agreement method, you could emasculate the rule?
I disagree with that with all due respect.
How do you disagree?
Because the way I disagree with it is, any party, whether or not there is a Rule 11 agreement, or there is no Rule 11 agreement, we exchange documents, and if they're sitting in my office, and my documents are sitting in the other party's office, any non-party, I believe, under the common law, has a right to come in and seek access to those documents, whether or not there's a Rule 11 agreement or not. And they, if I don't want to turn them over, or if they're subject to a Rule 11 agreement, then the court will have the 76A hearing and decide whether or not they're a public employee.
So then it's the bottom line of your argument that the reason why they don't get them in this case is because they asked for them outside the jurisdiction of the court. Is that the bottom line of your argument?
That, right now, that is all, yes, sir. That is all we're saying is they waited too long. They knew.
Oh, well, no, no. Oh, now you're starting to talk about waiver, not jurisdiction.
No, it was a public. It was file of record.
No, I'm saying, but do you agree there's a difference between waiver and jurisdiction?
There is a difference between waiver and jurisdiction.
And that's exactly what we're talking about here.
Well, but I don't...
Did you ever plead waiver?
I don't think the parties...
Did you ever plead waiver in this case?
We have never got to that point. We continued to...
Well, they're late to try to get to it here, though.
We continued. There was no jurisdiction. The trial court denied our motion. The Court of Appeals entertained its sustained mandates.
Mr. Cooper, can the actions of parties create jurisdiction in a district court?
They cannot. The parties, through their own affirmative acts, for example, through a rule 11 agreement, we can't create jurisdiction. Likewise, I don't think the parties, through their actions of waiver or estoppel, can confer jurisdiction. The waiver, either the court has jurisdiction or the court doesn't have jurisdiction based upon the face of the documents that are there in the record. And so I don't think waiver or estoppel is an issue in this case because no matter what we did, no matter what the Dallas Morning News did, Judge Marshall signed that judgment on January 14th, and 30 days later, his plenary power expired. Whether or not they had notice, they didn't have notice, whether or not we did something, we didn't do something, the plenary power expired.
And so you say the Rule 11 agreement is sort of a red herring, that with or without the Rule 11 agreement would have the same result.
Right. It's our position there are only two vehicles to extend the court's jurisdiction. One is a 76A sealing order, which is what the statute says, or the rule says. The other is a protective order, which under Keppel, this court held, is also subject to 76A. And again, one of the things that counsel said was that 76A applies to all documents. Well, if it applied to all documents, then why was it necessary under Rule 166B-5C for this court to say we're going to apply protective orders to the same rules as sealing orders? Otherwise, it would apply to everything. And so far...
Well, your argument was is because that's what Rule 166B-5 says, that it's subject to rule.
It does.
You remember that argument.
I remember that argument. And for sealing orders as well as protective orders, we have specific rules that extend the jurisdiction of the court. We do not have that rule with respect to Rule 11 agreements.
So your argument really is then that Rule 11 agreements are outside the scope of a 76A hearing situation.
They're outside
if they're after
the scope
30 days
of the continuing jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Suppose there is a disagreement regarding whether or not you have a 76A sealing order. And now it's 2 years. Where do we go to get that question resolved?
As far as whether or not there was a valid 76A,
well, the sealing order is covered under 76A.
Trial court has jurisdiction to determine jurisdiction, always. And so, if indeed the trial court determined that he or she had entered a valid 76A sealing order, then by that act, he or she could determine I continue to have jurisdiction. On the other hand, if the trial judge said this was not a valid 76A sealing order, therefore I don't have jurisdiction, then he or she would have that limited power to determine their own jurisdiction.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Cooper, let me ask you a couple of questions. Let's assume that we disagree with you and we say that there has to be some sort of sealing order of some nature in effect in order to confer continuing jurisdiction on the trial court. Can parties take away that jurisdiction by agreeing to revoke their Rule 11 agreement?
Yes, sir. Interesting question, Justice Owen. I would think that the court would have to say I would think the court's answer would be the same. Either there is jurisdiction to reconsider the Rule 11 agreement as a sealing order or as a Rule 11 agreement, or there is not jurisdiction. I'm not sure that
that parties could come back in and do something else to reconfer jurisdiction on the trial court, that our argument is that the effect of the Rule 11 agreement is the same as a sealing order. These records are sealed in the plain language of the first sentence.
So what if the parties come back and say, well, we've returned each other's documents and we've agreed that we've released one another from any further obligations under that Rule 11 agreement? Do we still have a sealing order in place under those circumstances?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think that if the Morning News, or and really this case isn't about the Morning News, it's about the public, and the Morning News is the representative of the public. If the public is still being denied access to records that are defined as court records under the rule, then I would think an intervener could still come in, subject to the time limitations that we were talking about.
Mr. Lutheran, the jurisprudence in Texas seems to be pretty strong that the parties, by their actions, can't confer jurisdiction on a court. And the argument here, it seems, if Rule 11 is the parties can have an agreement outside the court that we are going to agree among ourselves to seal these records. And we're going to file it in terms of a Rule 11 agreement and thereby force that court to take continuing jurisdiction. The court doesn't enter an order sealing it. It's just we agree to seal it, and we're going to file it with the court. And therefore, by our actions, we confer jurisdiction on the court. Can they do that?
Your Honor, that's not really our argument. Our argument is under the rule.
Well, your argument is the opposite of that. They've agreed to not seal it, and you're saying because they agreed to not seal it, they've conferred continued jurisdiction on the court.
I'm sorry. I.
Your argument is that they, by their Rule 11, have agreed
to seal it.
Yes. And I've asked you the question. Well, you say that confers continuing jurisdiction on the court because that's tantamount sealing. My question was, but can parties, by simply their agreement, confer jurisdiction on a court in Texas?
I wouldn't phrase it exactly that way, Judge, but I think under these facts, the answer is yes, that there is continuing jurisdiction. It happens to relate to the Rule 11 agreement because that is the document that seals the records.
So the parties, by agreement, can confer jurisdiction on a court.
As I said, I wouldn't phrase it that way, but I see your point. Yes, sir. Under the rule, what I'm saying, one thing, picking up on Justice Baker's questions, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Rule 11 agreement and the relationship between the Rule 11 and Rule 76A, because I think a key point is that Rule 11 starts out with the phrase, unless otherwise provided in these rules. And the comment to that section, which was added in 1988, says that makes it clear that Rule 11 is subject to modification by all the other rules of civil procedure. In effect, Justice Abbott is right, because what this allows the courts or the parties to do is to contract around Rule 76A. And it does create a large gap in the rule. What party on earth would go seek a protective order or follow the requirements of 76A if they could sign a Rule 11 agreement, particularly a vague one, sit back, cross their fingers, settle their case, and hope that the 30-day traditional plenary power period expires? The court is so familiar with the policies behind Rule 76A that they don't even bear repeating. But I would point out to the court that Kaiser's construction of their Rule 11 agreement is unenforceable because it would violate the rules, first of all, the first sentence of Rule 76A. It would also violate public policy. Justice Darling and Mike Buchetti argued at page 682 of their Texas Law Review article that agreements of counsel contrary to the rules were unenforceable as against public policy. They cited the Missouri Pacific versus Cross case, which is not in the brief, so I apologize for that, at 501 Southwest 2nd, 868-872.
Any other questions?
Well, let me just make sure I understand one thing.
Yes.
If there were no Rule 11 agreement in this case, could you still be here?
Yes. If there was denial of access to records that we as an intervener or any other intervener contended were court records, as defined under the
rule. Where would be the denial if there were no Rule 11 agreement?
we go to the parties in the lawsuit, Your Honor, and they say, no, we're not going to give them to you. It's simple as that. I think maybe I'm being too simplistic about approaching it, but a reporter sees a case that's settled, he goes in, he looks at the file, he says, gosh, I'd like to go see those financial projections or whatever discovery he thinks might be in the party's files. The parties say, no, we're not going to give it to you. No, we're just not going to do it. I think we could come in at that point under the first sentence of 76A7 and seek to prove that those are court records within the rule.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Counselor.
That concludes arguing in this case and today's arguments. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise.
Oye, oye, oye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.